When you think of international diplomacy, two words you might not think of are ping and pong. But our guest today traces the surprising history that links table tennis and international relations.
Nicholas Griffin says the game of ping pong has a long history of political intrigue. His new book is called Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. Nicholas, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, ping pong doesn't always seem like a sport of huge consequences when you compare it with some other high-profile games, but according to you, it does have an incredibly rich political history. Where did the idea to use ping pong as a political tool come from?
It actually came from the man who actually sat down and wrote the rules to the game. It had had this sort of brief burst of popularity in the late 19th century, but then it faded and died until this very wealthy young aristocrat came along and sat down and wrote the rules to the game. But what no one knew was that the same year he wrote the rules to the game, he started working for the Soviet Union secretly as a spy and actually worked for them in one form or another all the way through the rest of his life.
It seems like a pretty revolutionary idea. So how did he get from, you know, being a spy to thinking, hey, this ping pong thing, I could do something with this?
Well, the first part of the Soviet Union who sort of had him on the payroll, that's not fair because he wasn't actually paid, but it was called the Comintern, which is short for the Communist International. And their mandate was to sort of impregnate Western culture with communist ideas and in any way, shape, or form. So they tried to use absolutely everything. He was a filmmaker as well. He actually produced all of Alfred Hitchcock's early spy movies, not that Hitchcock knew he was a spy. But sport was another obvious sort of cultural medium through which he could contact a very large group of people.
So he could reach large groups of people with ping pong, but it's still, you know, people playing table tennis together. What's incendiary or revolutionary about introducing ping pong?
Well, the point for him was to then create an international table tennis federation, which he could start use to tying countries together around the world who didn't necessarily have diplomatic relations. Moments would be such as the Iron Curtain. He could move in and out behind the Iron Curtain without any questions being asked. That meant he could certainly, being a courier wasn't an issue, taking meetings all over the place wasn't an issue. And then it sort of got more and more serious once he got the Chinese involved.
Did he actually have a love of the game alongside all of the political intrigue?
No, his love of the game goes right the way back to a table he made his father buy in their vast mansion in Kensington, London, back around 1914. His ping pong was as one of his deep loves right up there alongside communism.
It's an unusual match, isn't it? And it did find a home in China. Why did it catch on so easily there?
Well, the good thing for this man, the Honorable Ivor Montague, was that it was fertile ground. So when he took the game and offered it to Mao and Premier Zhou Enlai in 1950, within 3 weeks of the foundation of the People's Republic of China, it turned out they both already loved the game. They used to play during bombing raids of Chiang Kai-shek on sort of the communist enclave in Yan'an.
Wow.
Zhou Enlai and Chairman Mao used to sit in a cave together playing a game of ping pong.
That's a surreal thought.
I know. So when he arrives in 1950 and offers it to them, he's already offered to many countries, including the Soviet Union, who are not quite that enthused as the idea of ping pong as a national sport. But in China, they leap on it.
And so it took root there, and it became something that was played across the nation, and they began to pride themselves on ping pong, it sounds like. How did it catch on?
Well, the good news is if you're the Chinese government and you want to do something top-down, the whole state structure was set up that way. So they copied a lot of the Soviet structures. And it was, very much an order from above. So, they'd start looking for players in school playgrounds. Then you'd be sent to a sort of night school for ping pong. Then it would be a sort of sports school for ping pong. Then you'd be picked up by your city team. And then you'd be scooped up by the national team. So it was all highly structured.
Wow, that's fascinating.
But they had these vast competitions, trying to get millions of people involved. Because the idea was that not that they wanted to play the sport, but they wanted to win an international competition for the first time and show that modern China was strong. Now, ping pong was an odd way to do it, but they knew they had a very good friend in Ivan Montague and they'd be protected, whereas they knew that things like the Olympics and the Soccer's World Cup were very much driven by Western democracies who they still didn't trust.
Well, it's interesting that they latched onto ping pong in a way because, you know, ping pong gets dismissed a lot of the time as being, you know, sort of table tennis light and tennis light, I should say. And, you know, you think, some people think, what is there to it? It's kind of a kid's game, but you can get pretty virtuosic on it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it doesn't carry a lot of weight in the rest of the world. That's totally fair to say. But, you know, that ends up being to China's strength when we get a little deeper into this story, the fact that no one else was really paying attention to it. But there, it was sort of just this first way for them to get their foot on this sort of, for what they considered international respect, and to show that they were no longer, you know, the sick man of China, which is how they'd been painted since the 1840s.
So at one point in 1961, ping pong was more than a recreation or a point of national pride. It was those things too, in a way, but it was also used to cover up a horrible famine where millions of people died. Can you tell us how ping pong was used in China then?
Yeah, I mean, you get this moment called the Great Leap Forward in the late 50s in China. And the idea here is that China is going to industrialize super rapidly, and they're going to overtake Great Britain steel production. They're going to overtake American grain production. But they have some very bad ideas that this is based on. One of those is the close planting of seeds, that seeds are like good communists, and if you put a whole lot together, they'll help each other grow. Now, of course, anyone who's ever done any farming knows that seeds will fight just like animals will, and everyone's fighting for light and water, and that they'll all die. So you have these horrible crop failures across China, along with several other factors, and it combines to make this incredible famine. And that famine kills, depending on Chinese statistics, say 17 million. The latest statistics done by a professor in Hong Kong say 44 million. The numbers are just extraordinary. And during that time, Ivan Montague, the head of the International Table Tennis Federation, the Soviet agent, brings them this sort of one ray of hope, and that's, would China like to host the World Table Tennis Championship in 1961? So coming towards the end of the famine here, they have this chance for this propaganda show to show that everything is absolutely fine in China. So they bring in foreign players, foreign officials, foreign journalists, and they set up this sort of Potemkin village situation where they get everybody in and out without a single crumb of knowledge of what's really happening in China leaking out of the country.
So it works. The ping pong ruse works.
It worked. It was so sort of benign in a way, which was what was so wonderful, and what the Chinese began to realize that it's rather a disarming sport. How on earth are you going to think of ping pong as political? And yet it was.
And the next big event that you profile, they'd already used it to great success in that case, but in 1971, 10 years later, it gets used again in another high-stakes gambit between the U.S. and China, who are having trouble coming together. How did ping pong enter into the picture there?
Well, you had this fascinating moment where it looks like the leadership of both respective countries have sort of figured out how to communicate alone. So in other words, Nixon and Kissinger have reached out without the State Department's knowledge, and Mao and Zhou Enlai have reached out without anyone else's interference. And you get this very slow motion back channel opening up in which handwritten notes are sent around the world in diplomatic pouches. And it's going very slowly, but it's pretty steady until the American side misses a grand signal. And that signal was that Chairman Mao put a left-wing American journalist standing on his right during a parade. Now, we missed that. We didn't understand that was part of this game that we were playing. So that meant that we didn't respond. So suddenly you had this chasm opening up again. And it had been 22 years since any serious conversation had gone on. So the Chinese needed to come up with a statement so obvious, so political, that everyone was going to get it. And the method they chose was this game of ping pong.
And just introduce us to the match a little bit. And it got some news coming up in about 30 seconds. What were those first moments like?
Well, it all the whole thing swirls around this relationship of two young men. One is an American hippie called Glenn Cowan, and the other is the best player in the world, a three-time world champion called Chuang Tse-Tung, and they're very, very different characters.
We're talking right now with Nicholas Griffin. He's the author of Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. And we're hearing right now the story of the 1971 match that brought the U.S. and China together.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think sports in general can provide the glue, as ping pong did, to bring nations together? Do you remember that 1971 match? Did you pay attention? Did it mean something to you? What do you think of using sports to a political end? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Nicholas Griffin. He's the author of Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. We're hearing the story of the 1971 match that brought the U.S. and China together.
And maybe you want to join the conversation. We'd like to hear from you. Do you remember that game? Did it grab your attention? Did you pick up ping pong, table tennis, after it got that worldwide recognition in that U.S.-China diplomatic event? You can call or with your questions at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Nicholas, let's go back to that match in 1971. It took place in China, and the U.S. folks went over there. What was the scene like when they arrived?
They were really the first big group of any consequence to enter Americans to enter China in 22 years. So most, when you talk to most of the players, many compared it to sort of stepping onto the surface of the moon. So little was known about China at that time. A lot of the people who studied it in the State Department compared it more to astrophysics to diplomacy. So everything was new, and everything was very strange. And for instance, the first big game, they're in the largest ping pong stadium in the world. It holds somewhere between 18 and 20,000 people, bigger than Madison Square Garden when it's playing a basketball game. But the big difference for these American players, who've rarely played in front of even 500 people, is that every single member of that crowd happens to be a member of the People's Liberation Army, all wearing the same thing. I mean, talk about a culture shock.
And the American star that you were talking about, he was a character. Talk a little bit about what it was like for him as he kind of went around in China and met people.
Yeah, he was certainly the first hippie ever to enter China. So any wonders with his sort of purple bell-bottom trousers and his yellow floppy hat and this white T-shirt with covered in peace signs saying, "Let it be." He's actually having a wonderful time because he's just decided to be himself. And, of course, the press members who've been allowed to go suddenly realize that this is the man to sort of build the story around. So you get this sort of bizarre symbiotic relationship between Glenn Cowan and the press, where it's very obvious that he's going to be the one they turn to because it's just a great story, an American hippie in communist China during the Cultural Revolution. It's just too good.
And it sounds like he made no secret of the fact that he didn't, mind getting high now and then, and there were some surreal moments in the media.
Yeah. He'd promised that he'd sort of thrown his stash away before he crossed the border, but apparently he hadn't. He took it in with him and was wandering around high as a kite half the time. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to think of. I mean, most of the people on that team were feeling this pressure of being turned from sort of athletes into sort of accidental diplomats overnight. And yet here he is, cool as a cucumber, just doing his thing as if he was back in his hometown of Los Angeles.
So what was that championship match like? How did the American game stack up against the Chinese game?
Well, the wonderful thing for the Chinese is they were by far the best team in the world, and the Americans, I think, finished that year ranked 28th. So they were in control of everything.
So it wasn't the match of the century.
It was not the match of the century, but the Chinese made it exciting. They threw a few games here and a few games there, but it's not as if they could get the crowd going because the crowd were made up of soldiers. So the crowd got going when the lights flashed to tell the crowd to get going. it was a very, very controlled atmosphere. But, you know, the really extraordinary thing, which the American players didn't know at the time, was how this was playing outside of China. Of course, inside of China, it's state-controlled press. It was sort of kept relatively quiet. But this thing spread like wildfire around the world. And Glenn Cowan was front-page news from the day he walked across and entered into China.
And what did that change for America and China?
It changed everything. I mean, the extraordinary thing was the first polls that were taken a couple of weeks after the Americans came back from China. Previously, the feeling of the American public was pretty much anti-China, anti-communist, as it had been for a long time. And yet, within 2 weeks, you've got that poll, which now reveals a majority of Americans favor communist China being accepted into the UN, which then, of course, goes ahead and happens that year. And what this maneuver of, you know, this highly meticulous strategy in China of creating this sort of ping-pong moment, it's provided this enormous political breathing space for both Kissinger and Nixon and Mao and Zhou Enlai to take their time and to sort of get things organized. And that leads to Henry Kissinger appearing on a secret mission that July in Beijing, and then the president himself. Nixon rolls into town in February of the next year in 72.
So they really opened the floodgates in a way.
They did. And actually, if you look at it, I mean, one of the early things you learn about negotiating in the arena of international relations is that, you know, the three most important things are location, location, location. And here the Chinese, who are by no means a strong nation at that time, the most populous nation, but not by far from the strongest, they have managed to get ping-pong diplomacy to happen in Beijing. They've managed to persuade Kissinger, who was willing to meet anywhere, to come to Beijing. And they've managed to convince President Nixon to come to Beijing. And that, in Beijing, is where they create the Shanghai Communique, which is the first new document in this new relationship.
Do you think this would have worked if it were a different sport? I'm imagining, for instance, American football. If they'd invited Americans to come over and play football, I can't imagine the American public would have been so kindly disposed to be trounced at football in China, and that it would have been this moment of acceptance. What is it about ping pong that opened the door?
I think it played perfectly from both sides. So to the Chinese, it let them feel as if they were always going to be the better team. They were in this position of power. They could throw games. The Chinese public would understand that. And from the American side, it was, you know, ping pong is this benign sport that supposedly belongs in basements and fraternity houses. So to us, it totally humanized the Chinese. It's like, you know what, these guys aren't sort of eating babies for breakfast. They're ping pong players just like us. You know, what could be more harmless?
But they were incredible ping pong players. I've seen some shots of the Chinese players from that game, and it doesn't look like, you know, a fluffy sport. It looks like these guys are real athletes.
Oh no, I mean, it was taken tremendously seriously over there. These guys were, I mean, they had the same regimen every day. They were lifting weights, swimming, marching through snow. I mean, you name it. It was
for ping pong.
For ping pong. I mean, it seems preposterous, but that's how seriously it was taken over there.
And so what is the legacy of that moment? Has it been used again, and is it something that really deserves to go down in the annals of diplomatic history?
I mean, I think it does, because it's just this absolutely unique moment. I think itself, the problem with it, I think, is that it sets a false precedent in that you have people wanting to check out basketball diplomacy and you know, wrestling diplomacy, and all these other things have been tried. But here you had something very peculiar going on, and that was that just before ping-pong diplomacy takes place, you have this political goodwill forming out of the blue, and it's secret, so nobody knows it's happening. You know, no, it's not covered by any press or newspaper. This framework that Nixon and Mao are creating between them. So the ping-pong diplomacy is interpreted absolutely correctly and timed perfectly and very much warmly accepted in the White House. I mean, it shocked the White House. They were very surprised when it came along. Kissinger was a little worried that it was going to upset all his back-channel shenanigans. But Nixon, within 24 hours, his favorite question to anyone entering the White House is, have you learned to play ping-pong yet? He got it immediately.
Wow, then that's a picture, too, Nixon playing ping-pong. I can't do it. So did a lot of people want to play ping-pong after this happened? Did it take off?
Yeah, it had a brief burst of popularity, and unfortunately for Glenn Cowan, the American hippie, he thought that he was going to ride that ping pong ball to fame and riches. And, you know, everything was wonderful for about a month, and he's on every chat show across America. He's with Johnny Carson, you name it, he's doing it. But then, of course, the sort of bubble bursts and ping pong returns to the basement, and poor Glenn Cowan is sort of set adrift.
Well, Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us. It's a great story.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Nicholas Griffin. He's a journalist and the author of the book Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World.